Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, joining you once again for a journey into the criminal mind. In this episode, we'll be dissecting the first of an especially fascinating yet horrifying series of disappearances that have come to be known as the Lewis Clark Valley Murders. From 1979 through 1982, at least five people mysteriously vanished from a rural region of the United States in the Pacific Northwest, along the border of Washington and Idaho, at the confluence of the Snake River and Clearwater River. To the west, on the Washington side, sits the town of Clarkston, which normally has a population of approximately 7,000 residents. To the south of Clarkston, also in Washington along the Snake River, is a town called Asotin, which has a smaller population of just 1,251 residents. Finally, to the east of Clarkston, on the other side of the Snake River, sits the largest of the three towns, which is Lewiston, Idaho, population 32,817. Lewiston is bordered on the north by the Clearwater River, while Clarkston is bordered on the north by the Snake River. At the point the Snake River converges with the Clearwater River, it makes a sharp turn south and constitutes the border between Idaho and Washington in that region. So, we have multiple states, counties, cities, and more specifically, criminal jurisdictions at play in the area. If you were a serial killer from 1979 through 1982, the benefits of such would be entirely apparent. Back in the day, there were no criminal databases that connected various law enforcement agencies in a way that they could keep one another readily informed of what the other was doing. In fact, not only was there a technological vacuum present, but due to that reality, it was common for the police in any particular place to not share what they knew with others. It became defensive and political, rather than simply a search for the truth. And the criminals of the day knew it. The Zodiac played the strategy to perfection, committing crimes across multiple cities and jurisdictions in a way that left law enforcement holding their evidence like cards at a poker table, trying to one-up each other with bluffs instead of finding the killer. Joe DeAngelo, the Visalia ransacker, East Area rapist, and Golden State killer, who was also a cop, was all too aware of how successful the strategy could be and avoided capture using it for over 40 years. One of the greatest technological shortcomings related to humanity is our lack of a collective intellect. We don't have access to what others know unless they share that information. So part of our evolutionary purpose is to construct one. Given that evolution is a conflict-based system and only progresses through action, we, as humans, require both people who are interested in creating such technological wonders and the people who will force them to do it by way of criminality and tyranny. That means we have to kill each other to progress, plain and simple. As technology advances, however, the necessity of utilizing physical violence to achieve that result decreases, and the need for security in relation to information increases. So if you're wondering why the 1970s fueled an unprecedented, enormous presence of serial killers, it was due to technological requirements of the time. The world was absent of computer databases, aka a collective intellect, that would further our evolution in that regard. What that process ultimately yielded, along with numerous law enforcement advances, was the internet, which is officially the first collective human intellect, a centralized hub in which nothing needs to be orally articulated because others can enter this brain, so to speak, and cherry-pick the information they require without interacting with others. This process is underway because in the future, humanity will be replaced by artificial intelligence, or AI, complete with artificial brains, or operating systems, that permit full connectivity with each other, which allows maximum efficiency. Violence, specifically criminality and warfare, are designed to not only create the necessity, but also fuel the continual plight leading to the technological solutions. Basically, if society needs a solution, then evolution must use nature as a way of inserting a roadblock in the lane you're traveling that must be removed to win. So let me show you how nature, or evolution, develops talent for its intentions. It's a really fascinating process. Now, if serial killers didn't exist in mass quantity prior to this era, why did they suddenly come to be? Sure, we had Jack the Ripper, the Axeman of New Orleans, or even somebody like Lizzie Borden. But in the 1970s, the sheer number of these criminals exploded in a way that had never happened before. Suddenly, it seemed as though every white man in his 30s was a serial killer, something that would have been unimaginable a generation earlier. So, evolution was able to utilize World War II for the purpose of absolutely astonishing technological advances. But warfare on that scale is definitely not sustainable. In fact, if there's anything we learned from that war, it's that we can't do it again. The technology involved in any future conflict of that size would end humanity. And that's intentional. It causes us to focus on winning informational wars rather than killing people. Mutually assured destruction forces us to do one thing: innovate. So when evolution, on the back end of World War II, has plans for a collective human intellect to arise, it can't return to warfare on that massive scale. In that light, it needs to have a different design. Therefore, we get decades of regional conflict, such as Vietnam and the Middle East, along with Cold War and a spike in domestic violence, specifically crime, in the form of murder. Now, if you need a ton of men who would otherwise not kill anybody to start killing, what do you have to do? Evolution must unleash societal circumstances in which men become disillusioned. And if the backbone of America is success at that time, prosperity, then that is the value that must be corrupted in order to grow men who feel inadequate in relation to what they thought they would be when they grew up. If you're nature, how do you do this? Simple. All of those men who came home from World War II went on to start families in post-war America, creating what is, even today, still a fairy tale image of American life. We were the best, and our country was the best. We couldn't be defeated. Men came home to victory, abundant jobs, and opportunity, to women who loved them. 1950s America became perhaps the greatest facade in the history of the world. There are still plenty of people who point to this era and say it all went downhill from there. It was blamed on a loss of values and the deterioration of the family. That's cute, but beneath your social reason for existence, evolution has its own plans. The male babies of these people who came home from war were going to be raised in a decade in which everything seemed to be perfect, allowing them that expectation of life, and then very suddenly, as they mature, it rips the rug out from underneath them and delivers the misery and despair of the late 1960s and 1970s. War, riots, urban decay, it came rolling down the mountain like a landslide, and there was nowhere to run to escape it. That facade of a perfect world was gone. The emotional fallout was so bad that there are still people trying to get back there, to the 1950s, hoping one day we'll go back to finding our wholesome values in a more innocent world, laced with niceties and no fear of what might be lurking in the dark. As that way of life dissipated, however, the young men who had grown up in it as boys felt displaced. Most of them simply did what everyone else did. They talked about the good old days and wished that they would return. but others were angry. Their fathers went off to war and returned heroes. But if they went off to war, they came home to get spit on at the airport by protesters. Families became so apathetic about each other's existence that we started to refrain from sitting at tables together to eat. Evolution even threw us a bone in the form of the microwave to compensate for it. All the nice, wholesome, slow, mom baseball and apple pie thing was dying fast. In that post-war time period, most children were raised exclusively by their mothers while the men went off to work. With that being the case, during that era, mom is the one who would have introduced you to the lifestyle you enjoyed. You'd have spent a lot more time with her at home while dad was away. So if you grew up feeling like the world into which you were born and subsequently raised is a lie, you're going to blame the person who introduced you to it. And that person, for those people in that era, was mom. So when all of these post-war boomer males are born into this bullshit mom and apple pie world, only to have it crumble once they reach adulthood and become disillusioned, who will they blame? Women. And what does that ensure? A generation of men are going to terrorize women on an unprecedented level, from abduction to rape to murder, in an effort to fuel technology that will assist in finding the killers and satisfying evolution's needs. Evolution plots stories the same way we do. This is why existence takes place in a dual context. In society, the goal is to find the bad guy, aka the killer, and put him behind bars. It's justice, good versus evil. But behind that social facade is evolution's purpose for doing anything. Technology. So in order to break down a case like the Lewis Clark Valley murders, our conduit to understanding the truth is going to be identifying the technological limitations present that rendered the necessity of these specific crimes to begin with. If we have a killer operating across multiple jurisdictions as a means of reducing or eliminating his chances of being caught, then what we can expect him to do at all times is to exploit the technological deficiency at hand until we finally innovate. Bad guys, from killers to dictators to the opposing team, are intended to be an obstacle in the path of success that requires you to do things you've never done before in order to succeed. Extraordinary success is derived from defeating evil through adaptation, including both evolution of thought and material innovation. So crime does this. It exposes technological deficiencies through loss, in order to allow us to see the truth and subsequently address the needs with innovation. If your store keeps getting robbed, you develop a surveillance camera. If people keep getting killed out in society, you seek better methods of detection to find the killers. If the killer works around your methods, it's time to develop new technology. That means, in this case, our killer's evolutionary purpose will be to close the gap on that idea of a collective human intellect, bringing us closer to it being a reality. Nature, however, can only communicate with humanity through intuition, symbolism, and metaphor. Therefore, in order to understand what the mission of this killer will be, in the context of evolution, we must find the symbolic and metaphoric offerings related to this case. Basically, evolution tells us what we need to build, not only by introducing a worthy antagonist who forces us to act, but also gives us instructions with imagery. And it's really easy to interpret these things. In this case, given the rural location and accompanying lack of law enforcement resources, along with the inability to efficiently investigate across jurisdictions, a serial killer is afforded the luxury of a strong disconnection between these entities. It's the perfect place for him to kill in one town and dump the body elsewhere, allowing the lack of cooperation among the police to derail their efforts in finding him. They need to foster connectivity in some way, and so nature offers that notion by placing this location in an area that necessitates building bridges between to connect them. That allows the people to interact. Nature puts the river there, and by default of doing so, asks, how will you cross? How will you connect with the people on the other side? The answer, as it was when the bridge was constructed, is clearly by utilizing technology to success. Lack of connectivity leads to ignorance, and ignorance fuels the serial killer's effectiveness. What he does is expose our technological deficiencies related to detection and integrity, which represent the dual values inherent in seeking universal truth. The better our technology is in relation to detection and integrity, the closer humanity is to achieving universal truth about who we are. Evolution moves relentlessly toward that goal because existence is nothing more than a reaction. We're simply reverse engineering a physical reaction to unveil the truth about the action that precipitated it. That's our goal in the universe and our goal in this case. Everything that happened after the Big Bang in our universe, right up to this day, is the formation of a technological strategy for learning the truth about who we are. The point, of course, is to learn how to construct another universe. Someone or something obviously constructed the world you live in at this moment, and that will be the collective job of humanity at some point, replicating that. In order to direct us as to what we need to create, nature affords us specific roadblocks to overcome. So, again, for instance, the people who settle the land around the confluence of this river know they need to be able to connect with those living on the other side. That will extract ignorance. In that light, they build bridges. Likewise, if humanity needs to evolve past being earthbound creatures and to begin colonizing space, nature throws us a global pandemic in which the only place in the universe it's safe to breathe air no longer offers that pleasure. We're forced to look at each other wearing masks, and that's part of nature's plan because it needs to show you the aspects of the human construction that need to be extracted from our bodies. So the mask covers the nose and mouth. That's the vulnerability from a physical standpoint. Our respiratory system is worthless outside of Earth's atmosphere, unassisted, and is becoming obsolete on Earth as well now. That's happening because we're approaching a place from a technological standpoint that will require greater exploration and colonization beyond Earth. Humans have operated within a context of being assisted by technology until this point in history. But what you're starting to see, which is equally horrifying, necessary, and beautiful, is that evolution, aka nature, is going to take more and more drastic measures to force us to change, but brilliantly do so under the guise of mistakes that humans have made. That way, we can still all blame each other, as we've always done in society, and evolution will be laughing behind the scenes as it gets us to do its dirty work. In this case, that will be a slow transition from being mortal humans to becoming artificial. The greater our capacity for technology related to detection and within the context of integrity, the more able we are to efficiently discover the truth. That's what all of this is about. The Lewis Clark Valley serial killer, along with the rest of these maniacs we've had in society over the years, were delivered by nature, or evolution, to expedite the process by way of necessity. Every time we investigate a case, our technological deficiencies are exposed. The idea is to realize them and innovate. That's the point of crime. So as we head into the first of the disappearances, 12-year-old Christina White, let's keep in mind that the chief of police in Assotin at that time was on the job for about 6 months and, in his own words, never had any training. He never went to any type of academy. And that's a tough road because life was different back then, especially in a small town. You wouldn't suspect one of your own if a girl suddenly disappeared. You'd look elsewhere while he was literally right under your nose. And that's basically what happens here. Let's examine Christina's disappearance and pay particular attention to the technological requirements of two values: truth and connectivity. So, it's the morning of April 28, 1979. Christina's mother, Betty Eminger, drives Christina and her 6-year-old sister, Carlin, from their home in Assotin at 328 Jefferson Street to a parade taking place downtown. They watch the parade and then have lunch in Assotin City Park. Afterward, they leave the park, driving up 2nd Street about 5 blocks to a residence located at 503 2nd Street. Christina is planning to meet her friend, Rose Clarnot, who lives there, and then ride their bikes down to the Assotin County Fair, where Rose will be showing a horse she keeps at a ranch. The home is located at the corner of Washington and 2nd Street, facing 2nd, so there's a neighbor on one side, on 2nd Street, but the other side of the home borders a road, which is Washington. So if you drove down Washington past this house, you'd be visible from the backyard and also able to see whoever was back there. Keep that in mind because it comes into play. So, this home is occupied by Patricia Brennan, who is Rose's mom, and Patricia's 10-year-old son, Clint Clarnot, along with Patricia's boyfriend, Lance Voss. Betty drops Christina off at 503 2nd Street with her bike around 1 p.m., last seeing her as she goes up onto the porch. Betty continues home with 6-year-old Carlin, which is a drive of only 7 or 8 blocks. Christina and Rose hop on their bikes and ride over to the fair, where Rose's mom, Patricia, is going to meet them to get the horse ready. Before long, however, Christina, who's known as somewhat hyperactive and neglectful of hydrating, starts to get sick. According to those who knew her, she was prone to heat exhaustion and suffered it on this fateful day. So, Christina decides she's going to ride her bike home, but she feels so sick by the time she reaches 503 2nd Street that she stops, goes to the door, and knocks. Lance answers for her, we assume, because Clint is in the backyard washing the dogs at the time. Christina asks if she can call her mom, and Lance lets her inside. He's obviously present at the time and hears the conversation between the two. Unfortunately, Betty can't come to pick Christina up at this time. There are a couple of versions pertaining to why, one being that she didn't have the car available, and the other is that Carlin, the 6-year-old, might have been napping. So, Betty tells Christina to get a cool wet towel to wrap around her neck and then sit in the shade to rest. They agree that Christina will cool off and then ride 5 blocks up to the corner of 2nd and Jefferson. Betty says she'll walk the 2 or 3 blocks down Jefferson to the corner where it intersects with 2nd to meet Christina and accompany her back home. If that seems odd, those last 2+ blocks going up Jefferson are especially steep. So, they end the call. Lance gives Christina the towel, and according to him, she hopped on her bike and went on her way. But did she? Christina White is never seen again, nor is her bike. Clint Clarnot claims he never saw Christina during that visit because he was out back, and furthermore, he wouldn't be able to say if Lance left the home either. He would have had a wide open view of Washington from the backyard, but not 2nd Street. Now, this is the type of street where some of the homes have dirt driveways, so people actually pull their vehicles over the sidewalk into the dirt or grass driveway, meaning there's no break in the sidewalk where it's dirt. This home at 503 2nd Street seems to be like that. It seems as though their driveway was dirt, and it was on the right side of the house if you're facing it on 2nd Street. So it's possible that someone could leave in a vehicle from that location, and a person in the backyard wouldn't know. I tend to think the likelihood is that the person would, though. However, Clint says he doesn't know if anyone came or went. He was out back the whole time. And Lance says Christina just got on her bike and pedaled off. So are you inclined to believe Christina White was abducted off the street or ran away in that span, never to be seen again, dead or alive? Or do you think suspicion should lie with the last person who saw her? There's no evidence of either circumstance transpiring, but we know from the result of Christina vanishing forever that one of them did. We do know sexual predators would abduct a 12-year-old girl on her bicycle. So could it have been a stranger? Was it somebody from the fair? Or the parade? Was she targeted by a predator who knew kids would be out and about that day, ripe for the picking? Here's the way I suggest we approach the situation. Logic. Christina White has visited this residence at 503 2nd Street twice on this particular day. The first time, she left safely and made it to the fair. We also know she made it back from the fair on her bike and returned to this residence to use the phone. In that second instance, while we're told that Christina left safely on her bike, we can't account for that assertion as being fact. Nothing supports it as being true. So if we examine the first visit in relation to the second, what has changed? We understand Patricia and Rose, who were present the first time, are no longer around. I don't know if Clint was in the house the first time, but the second time, he was not. Now, on that note, what we learn from all of this, in terms of dynamics, is that the difference between the first and second visits is that the second time, Lance was alone with Christina in the house, absent of any other people as witnesses. Notice what we have here. The technological deficiency is lack of connectivity. We don't know what happened here. Once Christina abandoned the phone, aka technology, ignorance ensues. Now, what that dictates is that she will fall back on regressive technology in order to try to succeed as a reactionary measure and fail. The regressive technology in question is intuition. She's going to make a bad choice. We don't have some sort of violent confrontation on the streets that clearly indicates there was a struggle and that she was taken against her will. As far as we know, there are no witnesses to her disappearance, despite the fact it happened in broad daylight. That says it was quiet, and more so indicative of Christina engaging with someone she trusts. And if she trusts that person, by way of knowing him, she'll do what he wants, especially because the way a predator like this operates is to offer bait. The bad guy has something they want, and they only need to want it enough to forego risk in that single moment. It always seems harmless. But once they step forward, they're trapped in his web. So at the time Christina is about to leave 503 2nd Street, we can say that, without question, what she wants most is to get home because she's feeling sick. Her mom, by extension of the car, is her conduit to getting there. But mom can't leave home right now. Christina agrees to ride the 5 blocks to Jefferson, but she's still going to have to accompany her mom along those last 2 grueling blocks straight uphill. Basically, in Christina's mind, mom's plan sucks. She's just doing the best she can to accommodate given the circumstances, but it really isn't any help. Christina is still going to have to physically go the whole way. So, mom had expected Christina to ride home from the fair, and therefore didn't plan to need to leave her home. So when Christina hangs up with mom, yes, she has a plan, but not a good one. Again, it requires her to physically do everything she was trying to avoid by getting a ride. So her desire remains the same. It hasn't changed. She's desperate to get a ride home. If we put Christina into the context of a protagonist in her own story, her want is to get home and stop suffering, but her need is to do what mom said and be safe. Given that circumstance, it stands to reason the most probable action that would have drawn Christina into a predator's web is to offer her a ride home at the time. Lance enjoyed the required connectivity to receive this information, meaning Christina's desire to have a ride home, because he was present when she said it to her mom. Of course, her mother was also on the phone, but not present in the room. So when the call ends, she's ignorant, she's in darkness. That means Christina has become a blind spot, so to speak. She's in a window of technological deficiency in which Lance is apparently the only person who knows exactly what's happening because he's present. Lance knows where she is, what she wants, where she intends to go, and can account for the most important element in any story, the reason why we're here. What happens next? We don't know. And we're ignorant due to technological shortcomings. That's why the serial killer exists. In the moment in which everyone else is predisposed to profound ignorance, and he sees a vulnerability in our capabilities of detection and integrity, he attacks them, but by way of attacking that which we care about, resulting in loss, and subsequently driving the need to innovate as compensation for our technological impotence of the past. We need suffering and death to drive that process. We need bad guys. We have to believe they're at fault because that's what supports the societal facade that veils evolutionary function. But without suffering and death as that mechanism, there would be no need to hide its existence, which is mind-blowing because it proves our creator is prone to shame and deception. These are not faulty human traits we've adopted through free will, and contrary to how we were intended to be. They're simply inherent in our design, because, by default of our creator's design, we mirror that. So, what I detect in this situation at 503 2nd Street is that the boyfriend, Lance, who was the last person to see Christina, as far as we know, is the most likely person to have been involved in her disappearance. Again, that's not an accusation of any kind. Rather, based upon my understanding of how evolution works, the point of greatest technological vulnerability would have been once she hung up the phone. And of course, that's the last time anybody but Lance sees her or hears from her. had she been abducted off the street while riding or pushing her bike, we would probably have a witness. Her bike might even be left behind. She's riding in a residential neighborhood in daylight. And again, her bike also would have had to have been placed inside a vehicle to conceal it. Aside from that, nobody reports seeing anyone being creepy or stalking her. So I think what we should do before proceeding is take a quick look at Lance's past. Who is this guy? Most kids are abducted by someone they know, and most people who are murdered are killed by somebody they know. Though we have endless horror stories of kids being snatched off the streets by a stranger, and they tend to be more sensational, offering increased media coverage, most kidnappings and/or murders render a familiar attacker. And it's easier to know what people are doing when you know them. You have access to information that offers the ability to calculate when their point of greatest technological vulnerability will arise. Criminals avoid getting caught by searching for the sweet spot on our technological vulnerability in the same way that they try to manipulate emotion. So in this situation, Lance not only possesses that moment of greatest vulnerability in relation to Christina's whereabouts, but he also has the greatest insight into her emotional vulnerability. And yes, that's a technological deficiency. Her suffering is going to potentially cause her to make a choice contrary to using good sense. Her mother told her what she needs to do. All Lance has to counter with is what she wants. That's who the devil is, and it's what he desires. The want over the need. Our emotions, like our flesh and blood bodies, are primitive, a shoddy construction. We're drawn to what we feel, and therefore mistakenly use emotion in place of data. When we're compromised, either physically or emotionally, that condition makes it difficult for us to indulge wise choices because we don't want to suffer. If you're a drug addict trying to cover emotional wounds, the drug is the want and quitting is the need. But if you're a 12-year-old girl trying to get home with your bike, you need to do what mom said and suffer, but still want to get a ride. And though she might have had every intention of doing just that, toughing it out, the devil on her shoulder, opposite that angel, might have been Lance offering a ride. And bang, right there, she runs headfirst into another technological deficiency. Her intuition says that because she knows him and it's her friend's mom's boyfriend who lives right down the road from their house, 7 or 8 blocks in all, it's safe to get a ride with him. But the deficiency here is that her intuition is incorrect. She's not using data because she doesn't have any way to access data about who this guy really is. The fact is, there's no way for her to know the truth. Whatever is in his head stays there due to lack of connectivity. So look what we have. It's not only an issue of integrity, but also detection. And the specific technological problem is lack of connectivity. We are all basically tarot card readers and crystal ball sideshows who offer ourselves false prophecies based in intuition rather than fact. It leads to something called rationalization, meaning, well, I'm not doing what mom said because I feel sick and want to get home. We're constantly speculating in our minds about what other people might be doing or thinking. The inefficiency of that is astonishing. And of course, we recognize that and live in a world today that is far more connected than it was back in 1979. So before proceeding with the story as it unfolds after the disappearance of Christina White, let's take a time out to examine if Lance is a worthy suspect. Does his character suggest he might be capable of this crime? Does he have a criminal record? Well, apparently, Lance Voss was only arrested one time, way back in 1972. But if you're waiting for me to tell you about a petty shoplifting incident, think again. Lance was arrested for criminal trespass outside of a funeral home. When later asked why, he claimed he was simply taking a shortcut across the parking lot at the time. But the truth is just a bit different than that. Okay, maybe a whole lot different. Anyhow, it's the evening of June 2nd, 1972, on a beach in Santa Cruz, California. 17-year-old Antoinette Anino was hanging out with her boyfriend, his brother, and the brother's girlfriend. At some point, Antoinette and her boyfriend got into an argument, and it became so heated they stopped on the beach to sit alone with one another for more privacy as the others kept going. Soon enough, though, according to the boyfriend, Antoinette became so frustrated she got up and stormed off in the opposite direction the others went. So the boyfriend goes back and finds the others, and they wait around for Antoinette to cool off and return. But she doesn't. And now the beach is closing. So they go back to look for her. But she's gone. They're approached by security people who ask them to leave. So at this point, they have no option but to call the police. A search ensues, but they find nothing initially. But then, around 3 a.m., Antoinette's nude body is recovered near shore. Her clothes and shoes are missing, but accessories like her wristwatch and necklace are still on her body. The medical examiner discovered no evidence of foul play and suggested her drowning was likely a suicide, that she had become so enraged by the disagreement that she lost control in that moment. It happens. But this time, there are questions such as, where are her clothes? And of course, the big one, which is, what really transpired on that night? Yes, her boyfriend could have drowned her during an altercation that never really got underway because he dominated her physically and left no damage to either party. If he was able to hold her underwater, that would have sufficed. If the clothes got damaged in the process, even just stretched, he might have discarded them in a trash can. With the beach area closing around that time, it's very likely someone would have been collecting the trash, and that an investigation would yield nothing. Of course, Antoinette legitimately could have drowned herself, and prior to doing so, stripped off her clothes and shoes, and she was the one who threw them in a trash can. With night approaching, she might not have been seen doing that if it's what truly occurred. What I don't think happened is that the clothes disappeared naturally and as a result of the drowning. Something should have been found. Nothing ever was. So, I detect the presence of redirected light, meaning someone moved her shoes and clothes, perhaps even removed them from the body. That's indicative of foul play, of course. Either way, the police have no evidence and charge no one. They never make an arrest. It's deemed a suicide. That was the night of June 2nd. Now let's move ahead in time to June 5th, 1972, just a few days later. Nearby, in San Jose, a man sleeping in his apartment above the Willow Glen mortuary hears noise outside during the night. So he gets up, quietly exits his front door, and tiptoes down the concrete stairs outside, leading to the entrance to the funeral home below. There, he sees a tall white man, perhaps 6 feet 4 inches or 6 feet 6 inches, dressed entirely in black, with a Polaroid camera draped around his neck on a cord. In the man's hand is a hunting knife with a blade that's perhaps 10 to 12 inches long. At that moment, the criminal is cutting the screen out of the window next to the door of the funeral home. The man coming down the stairs basically says, "Hey, who the hell are you and what are you doing?" The guy doing the breaking and entering turns to him and claims to be the boyfriend of a girl inside the building. He's so broken up about her death, he says, that he desperately wants to see her one last time. Of course, the only person in the funeral home that night and in the chapel was Antoinette Anino. Now, if that's not creepy enough, let it be known, this isn't even her boyfriend. It's some 25-year-old guy she apparently didn't even know. So how did he know her? Did this man cross paths with her at the beach and kill the teen, going back later because he couldn't bear the thought of not spending time with her corpse? Did killing her in the ocean and in a public place prevent him from enjoying himself to the extent he had hoped? We don't know, but if I have to guess, I think this likely was a suicide. In the time between going in the ocean to drown and her friends coming back, someone easily could have walked past, seen nobody claiming the shoes and clothes, and walked off with them. That's not uncommon in California. That would have been a score for a homeless person who's oblivious to a possibility of foul play at hand. So, we don't know what happened to Antoinette, but I'd guess it was a suicide. Now, how does this strange man get involved at the funeral home? Antoinette was a pretty girl, and they put her name and picture in the newspapers after the incident. There was also an obituary. All the guy would have to do is learn where the funeral services were taking place. Now, who would do something like that? Well, someone who liked violating the dead, of course. Now, we can't ignore the fact our perpetrator was carrying a Polaroid camera. Polaroids became synonymous with taboo activity, especially in relation to sexuality, because back in the day, you had to get regular film developed in public at a store. So the people at these shops would see your pictures. Polaroid offered less quality, but more security and convenience for those who really needed it. And if you're trying to break into a funeral home to photograph a dead woman, then you really fucking need it. You can't have those pics developed at your local Rite Aid. Of course, you and I also realize a 12-inch hunting knife isn't exactly the most efficient way to cut a window screen. In fact, it's probably the worst object you could use. A blade of that size would only be carried during the crime if you felt it was necessary. Obviously, it wasn't intended for protection or as used to aid in his getaway in signs of trouble, because he doesn't fight the guy upstairs. He's a very big guy and armed with a huge knife, but he makes no effort to get away. It's not difficult to see Dr. Frankenstein was planning to go to work on his subject once he got inside that building, armed with a 12-inch hunting knife and a camera. This is a sexually deviant crime, so obviously that it doesn't even matter that we never got to see what he would have done next. It wasn't going to be very nice. And again, these types of things are not uncommon among serial predators. Ted Bundy loved to pose the bodies, put makeup on them, and have sex with the corpses as well. In fact, he'd sometimes do it until the body had decomposed so badly it was no longer physically possible. But without a doubt, he loved returning to the body. And I think that's essentially what's going on here, whether this man killed Antoinette or not. He wants to enact this fantasy and take pictures for arousal in the future. Though the suspect in question is believed to have potentially committed violent crime since his teen years, I happen to believe he hadn't killed anybody at this point. A seasoned criminal of this kind would have attacked the man coming down the stairs and attempted to escape. Our guy never tried to run, and if you ask yourself why he didn't, despite being huge, strong, and having a knife, it's because he hadn't done anything yet that would warrant the paranoia of needing to escape. Criminal trespass isn't the end of the world, and is a whole lot better than abuse of a corpse, or any of the other horrifying charges he might have incurred otherwise. Later in this story, when we talk about another disappearance, when the stakes are higher because he's already committed the crime, when another person shows up, he'll kill that person, and he'll do it because, by then, he has killed people and does have secrets to conceal. Notice that when our suspect is asked at the moment of engagement what he's doing, he has no qualms about admitting, even falsely, that he was going to visit his dead girlfriend one last time. But when asked later, in relation to a homicide investigation, what this charge from the past was all about, he dodges the truth and says he was just cutting across the parking lot, and goes on to say that he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. So, back in 1972, when the guy came downstairs to ask him what he was doing, why didn't he just make up a lie? The reason is that he didn't have enough to hide, aka enough at stake, to lie. In the latter interviews, he's being asked in relation to multiple homicides. It's only at that point that he feels the need to try to disguise the truth about the 1972 case. In 1972, it's pretty clear he didn't have much of a guilty conscience about his wrongdoing. He almost tells the full truth about why he's at the funeral home, aside from the details he obviously wouldn't include, such as abusing a corpse. This type of behavior is a fairly typical precursor to murder. John Wayne Gacy, prior to going on a legendary killing spree in Chicago, moved out to Las Vegas as a young man and got a job at a funeral home where he also rented a room so he could abuse the dead. He didn't just want to engage in sexual acts. A lot of it was about intimacy. That's essentially what's going on with this man outside the Willow Glen mortuary in 1972. He wants to be alone with her body, for sexual reasons, for reasons of general intimacy, and also to engage whatever other fetishes he has. The fact this guy has a large hunting knife with him is very telling. The obvious implication is that he's planning to use this blade on Antoinette Anino. But for what? That answer, my friends, might come later, as we have a crime where such a weapon, and even more so, such a skill, would be appropriate to the task at hand. More on that in the next episode. But for now, what's important to know is that the 25-year-old man who tried to break into the Willow Glen mortuary in 1972 was none other than Lance Voss. Nothing connects him to the death of Antoinette Anino. However, he was charged with criminal trespass for his disturbing actions on the night of June 5, 1972. Both Gacy and Voss had a theme to these early transgressions. Rationalization. If the people are already dead, then what's the harm, right? You didn't kill them. But doing things like this is the equivalent of a gateway drug. A lot of killers do it. For them, it was dead humans. But guys like Dahmer literally started with roadkill. Terrorizing the dead and abusing animals constitutes common antisocial behavior among those who eventually graduate to serial crimes. It's like riding a bike before driving a car. So we have someone who has engaged in antisocial behavior in relation to the corpse of a 17-year-old girl, and again, a behavior that often leads to more serious crimes. Knowing this, and looking into the future, specifically April 28, 1979, do you feel as though Lance Voss being the last person to see Christina alive is suspicious? So getting back to the afternoon of April 28, 1979, right after Christina disappears, Betty, her mother, leaves home at 328 Jefferson in Asotin and walks 2+ blocks down the hill to the corner of Jefferson and 2nd. No one is there. But again, it's 1979, when kids would get on their bikes, disappear, and often not come home until the sun went down or when they got called in for dinner. At this point, it's just odd that Christina isn't at the corner. Yet, her mom knew she didn't want to ride up the hill, so she figures maybe Christina just cooled off with the wet towel, felt better, and went back to the fair. Now again, the town is very small, so it doesn't take her mom long to realize something is wrong. Christina's stepfather, Michael, gets involved, and in accordance with typical thought of the time, he believes the person responsible, if there was any foul play, was someone from out of town. So he starts questioning people over at the fair, and supposedly remains staunchly in favor of the theory that someone at the fair, meaning an outsider passing through, is responsible. He proceeds to follow the fair to other towns in the aftermath, but to no avail. That hunch didn't lead anywhere, and likely because, as I've said, you don't start with outsiders in an investigation. You start close to the victim. Who does she know? And who did she see that day before she disappeared? Right? Unless she was seen being snatched by a stranger, you first have to indulge probability. And probability in this situation says someone she knows did it. Of course, Christina's mom knows she was last heard from at 503 2nd Street, so she inquires of Lance, who tells her Christina just got on her bike and rode off. That was the last time he saw her, he says. But when residents of this little town get together in solidarity to search the area, Betty notices something she can hardly believe. Lance Voss shows up wearing a cool, wet towel around his neck, just the way she told her daughter to do. So she begins to become suspicious about this man. As the days go on, and Christina doesn't return, Lance allegedly starts giving a lot of suggestions about where to search when people get together to keep looking. He seems to be directing people towards some areas and away from others. Meanwhile, right from the start, what's apparent to me is that this is a crime that would be solved in about 5 minutes today. Why do I believe it to be so? Well, there's this house located at 819 3rd Street in Asotin, which is vacant at the time, but owned and maintained by a local resident. So it isn't empty, there's just nobody living in it. And why? Well, this person decided to move in with his girlfriend. That person, of course, is Lance Voss, who moved into 503 2nd Street with Patricia Brennan. And why is this important? Well, if, as Clint Clarneau claims, he never saw Lance or Christina come and go from his vantage point in the backyard, that would mean whatever vehicle Lance intended to use was parked in the dirt driveway out front. This is where details are important because you have to understand the psychology of avoiding detection. This is all about technological superiority. The killer doesn't want to be detected. So let's say, hypothetically, Lance hears the phone call between Christina and her mom, and subsequently offers her a ride home. She accepts, but he offers the caveat that he needs to stop at his other house on the way. And that's convenient because it is on the way, and it's located just prior to that hill she wants to avoid. So let's say they get in his vehicle and put her bike inside. They're going to drive along 2nd Street one block and make a right on Lincoln. At the next block, they'll make a left onto 3rd Street. They're going to drive another 2¾ blocks, arriving at 819 3rd Street, where Lance's unoccupied house is located. Now, again, here's the thought process behind what he's doing. Not only is this route one that takes him right past his other house, but it's actually also the fastest route to Christina's home. So, as I said, the killer, if this is how it happened, would allow himself the option of committing this crime. If he isn't seen driving with her along the way, or even loading the bike before leaving, then he can assume he remains undetected. Of course, he also knows from listening to Christina's conversation with her mom that mom is planning to walk the 2+, almost 3 blocks down the hill on Jefferson to meet her daughter at the corner of 3rd Street and Jefferson. If mom goes to that corner and sees them in the vehicle going to Lance's other house at 819 3rd Street, then he can just abandon the plan in his head without incurring any risk. In this circumstance, he either gets what he wants or does what he needs to do. And that's why the crime happened, in my estimation. Nobody saw anything. A lot of people would have been at the fair and downtown after the parade. It was an optimal time to do this. The person of interest had all the info he needed. Look at the profound ignorance a distance of only a half mile between Christina and her mother caused. 40 years later, we still don't know what happened. That lack of connectivity makes people extremely vulnerable. Today, we have smartphones. Like the bridge across the river, they bring us together when we're far apart. Like telephone landlines before them, cell phones aren't a solution, but a progression. Now, again, as Lance is nearing his other residence and sees nobody is around to witness him, including neighbors, passers-by, or even Christina's mom at the corner, he's going to make an excuse to turn into the driveway for this other house. If he does that, he can potentially lure the girl inside with the promise of something like a cold drink. He knows she's dreading that last 3 blocks up the hill, and is likely going to be nice, so to speak, in accommodating the request to follow him into the house. As before, he can still lure her inside and choose not to commit a crime if he's seen entering the home with her. Her bike is already in the vehicle, so nobody is going to see that. If they walked into the home unseen, then in his mind, he'd have license to proceed because when he walks out again, if he's seen, so what? It's his house. He's alone. Even if Christina's mom sees him from the corner when he leaves the house, he's going to be by himself. So even if only intuitively, the killer realizes the technological implications at play. Now here's what we should notice about the crime. He wasn't out hunting for a victim. He took advantage of an opportunity that appeared to be perfect for him. So what kind of killer would adopt an MO of opportunities coming to him when they're perfect, rather than acting in haste to acquire his next victim? Well, more than likely, somebody who's already been caught. Like what happened to Lance in the Antoinette Anino incident. He went to her, actively in search of a victim, and unprepared to avoid detection, and accordingly got caught in a matter of seconds. He didn't do anything to prevent the guy sleeping upstairs from waking at the sound of someone cutting the window screen. And due to his lack of consideration for technology, even just in the form of human hearing, he was busted. A criminal of that type would be more inclined at that point to indulge self-preservation and be paranoid about getting caught, because this crime establishes his character. He has a fucking Polaroid camera and a hunting knife heading into a funeral home where there is only a 17-year-old drowning victim inside. So in this Christina White case, I believe he acted because he felt he saw the perfect opportunity to remain undetected afterward, and that subsequently became a pattern that he repeated over time. In all five of the disappearances in this case, we're going to have a circumstantial basis for the crime, rather than one involving premeditated targeting of a specific individual. In each of these cases, we learn of a situation in which the killer saw a great opportunity and took it. That's no accident. I think this man was psychologically damaged by the nature of the arrest in 1972. It revealed him for who he was, even if he didn't get in a lot of trouble. I believe it made him more vulnerable, aware, and opportunistic as a measure of self-preservation. In fact, it would seem that's why he came to the area in the first place a year earlier. Nobody knew who he was or what he'd done in the past. He had a clean slate and in a place where multiple cities, states, and criminal jurisdictions converged. Throw in the isolation and abundant mountainous terrain, this place is a winner. A serial killer could thrive here in terms of getting away with his crimes. But when you do something like this in a small town, or across a few of them, people know. And so began the legend of a local boogeyman, Lance Voss. Again, he's never been charged, and I don't have any evidence of his guilt in these disappearances. Whether intentional or not, the circumstantial nature used in choosing the crimes led to the evidence amounting to the same. It's circumstantial. And it points to one man. Now, if you think I'm being highly speculative about the potential for Lance Voss committing a violent crime against Christina White after luring her into his vacant residence at 819 3rd Street in Asotin, check this out. At a later time in the next few years, Lance Voss, according to a local realtor, contacted her to come take a look at his home because he was interested in selling it. When she arrived, he allegedly kept urging her to come down into the basement with him because he'd just done some work down there that he wanted to show her. So as she's looking around the house, she suddenly gets a strange feeling like someone's over her, looming, and she turns around. Apparently, Lance had been standing behind her with something raised over his head, which he then quickly hid behind his back as she looked. She asked to see what it was, and it turned out to be a large wooden bedpost. He'd been holding it like he was about to strike her over her head. He then proceeds to ask her who knows she's at this house. When the scared woman tells him that multiple people know she's there at the time, he suddenly loses interest in showing her the basement. Anyhow, Christina White, to this day, is still missing. Her remains have not been recovered. But a few weeks after her disappearance, a local rancher makes an eerie discovery on his property. Now, normally when you listen to a true crime podcast, people are just going to say, they found the papers. And that's that. But you know I'm going to approach this with exhausting detail to try to learn the truth. Here's what I understand. Our perpetrator is an opportunistic killer but his audacity requires him to turn into a Shakespearean actor afterward because he was the last person seen with the victim. Thankfully for him, Lance is well-versed in all aspects of the theater, as you're going to learn later, in a big way. Now, since he took advantage of a perfect opportunity to remain undetected while abducting Christina, this person, who is obviously a sociopath, won't have to hastily assert himself during the crime like he did at the funeral home while trying to break in. Anytime you're dealing with a sociopath, if one of his actions in relation to a crime is done out of desperation and in haste, rather than by way of technological considerations related to remaining undetected, it should produce comedy, specifically dark comedy. For instance, Jeffrey Dahmer once walked out of the Ambassador Hotel with a grown man inside a suitcase. A grown fucking man. When sociopaths find themselves in circumstances they can't control, they try to shortcut a favorable result by redirecting light. For instance, now that the crime has been committed, evolution is going to swarm, meaning the cops, neighbors, families, and friends will scour the darkness of the situation to find the light. They'll search for Christina, they'll ask questions, and they might learn some things. So, the sociopath hates this because it means other people control the narrative. They'll search where they like and speculate in whatever manner they see fit, which is terrifying as the bad guy because they're all trying to detect you. So we have Lance allegedly telling people to search in certain areas and not in others. Law enforcement around town said he regularly asked them for updates on the case, and right out of the blue. He wanted to know what the cops knew, of course. So generally, what all of this leads to, all of that paranoia, is the sociopath engaging in misdirection. Misdirection is an important part of trying to deceive those investigating you, but in constructing a false narrative, if done by way of planted evidence, you walk a fine line between legitimately framing someone for the death and creating a comedy show. Sometimes, however, the result falls in the middle, and what you get is confusion. That's the case at the ranch, but I'm going to make sense of it for you through psychological examination. Here's what transpires a few weeks after the crime. The cops are looking everywhere, and so are residents. But where do they search? Outside. That's why they didn't find her. Not only did they look exclusively outdoors, but they also used outsiders as the main target of their suspicion. That method, combined with waiting 24 hours to officially investigate, rendered a circumstance in which they'd be looking for something that's no longer there. What I know, just like the killer here, is that all you need to do is wait for people to stop searching outdoors and then dump the body. By the time they realize the evil came from within, as it normally does, there won't be any evidence inside the vacant home. It's common for killers to dump bodies in areas that have been searched already. Doing that delays or prevents recovery of the victim's remains. Now, you'd have to imagine that if you were the last person to see this girl alive, and her mother was suspicious, your wife will also be suspicious when she gets home. Of course, we do know criminals of this sort, meaning sociopaths, tend to marry women who either feign ignorance or don't want to know the truth, but this conversation is obviously going to happen between Patricia Brennan and Lance Voss. They're a serious couple, living together, and ultimately going to be married. So, trust is a part of that, we assume. You'd have to think Patricia would be highly suspicious, at least, and she's going to ask Lance what the hell happened. So, if you're Lance, you not only want to thwart the swarm of evolution in the form of everybody else I just mentioned, but also want to appease your wife to keep her at bay. Okay, so this is when we head out to the ranch belonging to Carl Flynn. Now, the big problem with the suspect abducting the girl in town is that they keep looking there and believe somebody came across her as she rode back from the fair. A natural course of action, considering the body is likely in another jurisdiction now, is to plant evidence in your jurisdiction, but evidence that leads away from you. That's the whole point. You want to dump the body across jurisdictional lines, especially state lines, and plant false evidence in the opposite direction, leaving you in the middle. He's creating space with that method, both physical and emotional. It's breathing room from the anxiety of hiding what everybody wants to find. Anyhow, rancher Carl Flynn's horse farm resides in Assotin County at 2322 Assotin Creek Road, close to 2 miles outside of town, in a rural, mountainous area with a plush valley below. So the ranch is basically the valley full of trees and brush, with steep canyon walls surrounding it. There's nothing else around except a road that runs through the ranch, which is, of course, Assotin Creek Road. That road runs along the north wall of the canyon, while Assotin Creek borders the south side. So this is what happens. Rancher Carl Flynn, who is 71 years old today and still lives at the property, would have been about 30 in 1979 at the time of Christina's disappearance. He crosses the ranch one morning, heading parallel to Assotin Creek Road as he makes his way toward the opposite side of the ranch where the horse pasture is located. The ranch is literally bordering the road, with nothing more than a short, steep slope of gravel and stone leading up to the road's surface above. Between the edge of the ranch where the grass stops and the slope leading up to the road begins, we find a barbed wire fence. So, Carl has the fence and the road beyond it directly to his right. He moves along the edge of the ranch toward the opposite side, where we finally reach another barbed wire fence that runs perpendicular to the one on his right, meaning it crosses the ranch instead of running along the road. So there's a fence in front of him bordering the horse's pasture, and also a fence to his right bordering the road. At the point those two fences converge, Carl notices something lying on the ground right outside the fence bordering Assotin Creek Road at the bottom of the slope. It's a grouping of papers seemingly in good shape. He collects them. So, what are they? It turns out they're school papers, homework, tests, things like that. But that's not the scary part. What he notices next is that the papers clearly belong to Christina White. Now, the bottom line here is that if you approach the horse pasture by crossing the ranch, you'd find the papers. In the documentary Cold Valley, Carl Flynn is shown at this spot on his ranch, standing alongside Assotin County Detective Jackie Nichols, who apparently still works the case in her spare time. And they're looking at each other, baffled as to why those school papers would be found there. But it's one of those things where they can't see the forest for the trees. Carl is a taller white man, like Lance, and only 2 years different in age. A witness to the crime back then easily could have mistaken these men at a distance, or if the view was obstructed in some way. What Carl and the detective don't realize is that the whole point of the papers being thrown there is to throw shade on Carl. But what the killer intended didn't happen, so it led to confusion rather than success. Here's the deal. Again, hypothetically, if Lance drove past the ranch on a Soton Creek Road, leaned out the window, and threw the papers down the slope toward the fence, it would only take a matter of seconds. Then he drives away. Simple, right? Now, why would he do that? Well, here's where the two birds with one stone aspect comes into play. Lance's girlfriend's daughter, Rose, keeps her horse at the ranch. So those two, meaning Rose and Patricia, go there to visit the horse. While I don't know for sure, I imagine Carl also provided transportation for the horse to and from events like the Assotin County Fair, as he probably did for other people who kept their horses with him. It stands to reason a horse rancher who lives less than 2 miles from town and even closer to the fairgrounds would be present at the fair on April 28th. Not only might he have had contact with Christina on that day, but he obviously knew her from having her and Patricia boarding the horse there and visiting the animal. Now, imagine this. Lance would like to alleviate suspicion from the police and his girlfriend. He lives with his girlfriend, so he knows when she and Rose plan to go out to see the horse. What he wants to do is leave those papers in a place where it will not only look like Carl Flynn is potentially involved, but he also wants to do it at a time in which he thinks his girlfriend and her daughter will be the ones to find the papers. If Carl finds them, he obviously knows he's innocent and a good guy, so he's going to report them to police. They have no reason to believe he did anything suspicious. And that's the reason it backfires. Carl isn't going to look guilty if he's the one turning the papers in. On the other hand, if Patricia and her daughter show up at the ranch to see the horse, or any other townspeople go to visit their horses, and Carl hasn't seen the papers first, they're going to find them, connect the dots, and think he's potentially involved in Christina's disappearance. They're not going to go to Carl with the papers. They're going to go to the police. This suspect was taking a shot at trying to avail himself of suspicion with the cops and his girlfriend, but again, this opportunity didn't come to him. It wasn't perfect. He forced it. And that means he didn't have control of who would find the papers. He could only estimate when would be the best time for him to both avoid detection and try to ensure someone other than Carl found them. But that method didn't work. It was a long shot. Christina's papers simply don't allow the context the perpetrator desires because the innocent man being targeted finds them before anyone else and turns them in. They were also in great shape and had obviously only been lying on the ground for a day or two, at most, when Christina had been missing for weeks. This effort is simply not enough to garner legitimate suspicion directed toward another person. She disappeared on a Saturday and likely wouldn't have had her backpack with her. I don't know how the suspect would have acquired her school papers, but given the fact that he was involved with the searches, it's certainly not out of the question that he was in her home in the weeks following the start of that activity. His future stepdaughter, Rose, who was Christina's friend, also went to school with Christina, so it's not out of the realm of possibility that he took the papers from the school the girls had attended. But again, these papers still don't connect to a true narrative. There's no context. That's why nobody has seemingly been able to figure out what they really meant. The suspect made a half-assed effort to manipulate the formation of a specific narrative and failed. Had someone else found the papers and gone to the cops, suspicion about Carl Flynn would proliferate. The problem with that strategy, though, aside from needing luck to go your way, is that the suspect would know beforehand that there's nothing to find. Carl is innocent, and Christina is not located on his ranch. Again, what the suspect hopes will happen is that someone other than Carl Flynn finds the papers and turns them into the cops, leaving people to continue to suspect Carl because no evidence ever arises to nail him. But why would the suspect want that exact circumstance? Well, because it's what happened to him after the crime. There's no physical evidence to implicate Lance, but people in town began to whisper about the boogeyman. Our suspect wanted to throw shade on Carl Flynn to make him that guy in people's minds instead of having himself in the role of the villain lurking in the shadows. And why? Because like serial predators do, our suspect was going to kill again. And if those crimes seem similar, people will, once again, be suspicious of him. What a killer like that needs to do is change his MO. He has to do something different that sticks out in a way that says this was definitely somebody else. That's especially important in a rural area in which nobody forgets that you were the last person to see Christina White alive before she disappeared forever. Accordingly, what happens next is nearly unspeakable. On June 26, 1981, 22-year-old college student Kristen David got on her bike with the intention of riding from Moscow, Idaho, down to Lewiston, a remote 30-mile stretch that's mostly downhill. But at some point along the way, Kristen vanished, along with her bike. On July 4th, just over a week later, her dismembered body was dumped over the bridge at Red Wolf Crossing into the Snake River. The remains were wrapped in newspaper, and the newspaper was stuffed inside multiple black trash bags that were tied and dumped. But to this day, due to lack of physical evidence, Kristen David's killer remains unknown. So in part two, we'll delve into the details of Kristen David's unsolved abduction and murder. But for now, I think what resonates most with me about the Christina White case is that it was one of those things that shattered the town's innocence. Girls didn't vanish while riding their bikes home from the fair. It was a place and time in which you trusted your neighbors. People could walk down the street at night without fear. And that's wonderful. It really is. But peace stifles evolution. Nature sends these monsters to assault technological complacency in relation to detection and integrity. The reaction in the community, of course, after this crime, would be one of greater concern and distrust, meaning more focused efforts to know their kids' whereabouts or accompany them, and less inclination to blindly trust neighbors. That poses the following question. How can I better keep track of my loved ones? And as I said earlier, since that time, that explosive era of murder and kidnappings, we've developed technology to keep apprised of what people are doing in real time. In 1979, however, nothing of the sort existed. You used the phone at one location and then couldn't contact anyone else until you got to your destination. It was in that window of vulnerability in which Christina was taken, and the psychological effect, in the form of our desires leading to technology, shows that the fear and distrust we say is the reason for societal breakdown, specifically in the form of the breakdown of the community, is necessary to fuel innovation. We want peace leading to prosperity, but evolution needs conflict leading to technological gain. It's that irreconcilable, ironic circumstance that makes our existence not only contradictory, but tragic. We're designed to sometimes kill each other to satisfy evolution's technological needs, from serial killers to warfare. But we also need to be horrified by killing to serve society's desire of achieving peace and prosperity by eliminating the evil that causes our struggle. And so, we are always searching desperately for new and better ways to prevent loss. It leads to many beautiful, amazing creations that enrich our lives. But it has a cost. Christina White was a victim in the universal struggle to rid ourselves of ignorance through a constant process of addressing our technological vulnerabilities related to detection and integrity. But more importantly, she was an innocent 12-year-old girl who lost her life to a vicious predator who has never faced justice for the crime. I can't imagine the horrors she faced in her final moments, nor can I possibly understand what her family endured in the aftermath, never knowing the truth. But what I can do, what we all can do, is continue searching for Christina White and all of the other victims of these horrible unsolved crimes. Because the answer to what happened to these people, in the end, becomes the answer to who we are. So perhaps if we keep searching and never give up, we'll finally find what's always been missing, even in our hearts.